The message you are about to hear is the last, the 12th, in Bishop John W. Howe's series on the Gospel of Luke. This message is entitled, Defeat and Victory.
We're in the last couple chapters of Luke's Gospel, and I would just comment that the events of the last 24 hours of Jesus' life are so tightly compacted that some scholars have argued there had to be 2 days between the Last Supper and the crucifixion. That is not the predominant view, but it is one that has some popularity. Just to recount the overall picture again, a familiar one to us, Jesus goes from the supper in which he identified himself, his own body and blood, with the elements of the Passover meal. He goes from the supper to the Garden of Gethsemane, where he prays for some considerable time. It's there he is arrested, betrayed by Judas, and arrested, and then taken to a series of 4 trials, or perhaps we ought to call them hearings or arraignments. They appear to have been quite brief, each one of them, but 4 separate arraignments. The first is before Caiaphas in the Sanhedrin. Second, before Pilate, who really does not want to deal with this at all. He is delighted to discover that Jesus is from Galilee, because that technically makes him Herod's problem, and Herod happens to be in Jerusalem at the time, so Pilate sends him across town to see Herod, and Herod sends him back again. And you remember that Pilate washes his hands and turns Jesus over to the crowd. Interspersed with all of that, he is beaten by the soldiers. So at the very least, and it may be more than this, Jesus has been up for more than 24 hours without sleep. He is in the midst of emotional, spiritual, and physical crisis. Many people have wondered when he prayed in the garden, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Was he doubting? Did he lose his faith? I thought he had been predicting this was the inevitable finale from the very beginning of his ministry. What happened there in the garden when he asked God to take the cup from him? I have no question whatsoever that Jesus feared and abhorred the physical agony that he was about to undergo. He was a human being. In every point, just as we are, except without sin, he had to abhor that. But I'm convinced that his request was on a much deeper level, a much, much more profound level. Jesus was one with the Father from before the foundation of the world, from all eternity. He had known a perfect oneness with his Father. And even in the midst of coming among us, that oneness was unbroken. I can do nothing of my own accord, only what I see the Father doing. Whatever he does, that the Son does likewise. There is an uncanny sense that runs all the way through the gospel account of Jesus sort of checking out the circumstances, whatever they might be, listening to the voices of people around him, and yet somehow at the same time being in touch with his Father and getting direction from his Father. And now, on the eve of crucifixion, I don't think it's the physical agony that is the most horrible thing that he anticipates, but the separation. It's almost beyond our ability to conceive, because no matter how great human relationships we have ever known, we've known nothing like his relationship with his Father. And he's about to go not only through the cross and death, but whatever it means, he descends into hell, he goes to the place of departed spirits, he enters into God-forsakenness. And I believe his prayer in the garden is, Father, if there is any way that this atonement can be accomplished without my having to be separated from you, please, if it be possible. But he consistently adds, nevertheless, not my will, but yours. Martin Luther called him the God-forsaken God. The God-forsaken God. My God, why have you abandoned me? It's a self-contradiction, isn't it? The God-forsaken God. And yet that is precisely the point. That is exactly what the essence of the crucifixion was, a self-contradiction. Physically horrible beyond our imagining, but more profound, I believe, is the separation from his Father. Jesus has been betrayed, abandoned, humiliated, scourged, beaten, and mocked. And if Isaiah 50 is a messianic prophecy, as it appears to be, he's had some of his beard ripped out of his face. Isaiah 50 says, I gave my back to those who struck me, and my cheeks to those who pulled out the beard. I did not hide my face from insult and spitting. Well, Pilate finally says, I can find no fault in him. And yet he acquiesces to the crowd, and he has Jesus flogged a second time. In failing to render unto Caesar what he owed to Caesar, namely a fair trial and a just verdict, he failed to render unto God what he owed to God. In the middle of all of that, we see Herod for just a moment. Herod, it says, Herod was glad to see Jesus, for he hoped he'd entertain him. Maybe he'll do one of his little signs, a little magic trick, but Jesus was doing no magic tricks that night. As we move on into chapter 23, it talks about another man who had been arrested by the name of Barabbas, son of Abbas. And Matthew, in some of the texts of Matthew, it adds the irony that this Barabbas, that's his surname, son of Abbas, his first name was Jesus. So we have the irony of two Jesuses. And this one is facing death for insurrection and murder. Pilate offered the crowd their choice for release, it being a custom that at the time of the Jewish holy days they could have the prisoner of their choosing, and Pilate quite clearly hoped that they'd pick Jesus of Nazareth, but they demanded the other Jesus. Just put yourself in his shoes for a moment. I wonder how you'd feel if you were suddenly set free while another man went to death in your place. The truth of the matter is, that's exactly what's happened to each one of us, isn't it? Verse 26, as they led him away, they seized a man, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming from the country, and they laid the cross on him. Jesus carried his own cross as far as he could before collapsing with exhaustion. Actually, he probably just carried the cross beam. The typical way of crucifixion was to leave the upright in place and use it over and over again. And the prisoner would carry the cross beam and either be tied to it or nailed to it or both. And then they would hoist that up and drop it onto the upright. You can just imagine the force of that if you're hanging from nails through your wrists. By the way, the word is translated hands, but the use of that word in the original was the hand and the forearm. So it is virtually certain that the nail went through the wrist where the bone structure was able to carry the weight. If it was just in the soft flesh of the palms, it would obviously tear through. Jesus stumbles and they compel this passerby an African named Simon to carry the cross the rest of the way. Says he's from Cyrene, which still exists today, although it has another name. It's called Tripoli, Libya. Not a very great distance, less than a couple of miles. There are two possible sites for the crucifixion. The more famous and more well attested is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which was a site determined by Constantine's mother. When Constantine was converted, he sent his mother back to the Holy Land to try to identify as many of the sites of the story as possible, and she identified the site on which the Church of the Holy Sepulchre has been built, and it is a remarkable place. It is a huge church in which the last three stations of the cross are said to have actually happened right there within the space that the present building occupies, full of incense and candles, and a very, very strange place to a Westerner. The other one is called Gordon's Cavalry, Calvary. Gordon of cartoon fame was meditating, not at all happy with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and suddenly in his meditation realized that he was staring at a rock face that resembled very much the shape of a skull. A couple of huge caves in it where the eyes would be, and it kind of looked like a skull, and he began to wonder, could that be the place of the skull? And discovered at its base a vineyard, and discovered in the vineyard a tomb, a first century tomb, and that is maintained today as the alternative possible site. And I just mention that because if you don't know it, if you haven't been there, there's another deep irony about all of that. We have the songs about on a hill far away stood an old rugged cross. Virtually all of the biblical scholars would say it wasn't on the top of the hill. It was at the foot of the hill, where passers-by would pass by. It was at the site of this place of the skull, whatever that was, but it was down at ground level. And if that is so, and if it turns out that Gordon's cavalry, I keep saying it wrong, don't I? Calvary, I look at the word and it looks funny. If that's the site, the present thing on that site is a bus station. They stripped him. We always pretty that up by draping him in a loincloth. He probably was naked. Of all but a cruel, mocking crown of thorns. And for 6 hours, he hung there. We celebrate the last three. Mark's gospel makes it clear it was 6 hours. The latter three, from noon to three, this strange darkness covers the area. Jesus was literally suffocating in his own body. Crucifixion is death by asphyxiation. You can't get rid of. It's the worst part is expelling the breath in your lungs. You can't do that without hoisting yourself up with incredible effort and pain in order to get rid of that breath and take another one. And his lungs are slowly filling up with fluid. Put all four gospel accounts together, and we have a total of 7 last utterances from the cross. Luke only records 3 of them, and they're an interesting 3. All of them are very positive. Luke does not record the cry of dereliction, my God, why have you forsaken me? Luke records these 3. Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. Verse 34. They thought they knew what they were doing. Judas, I believe, thought he was forcing Jesus' hand. I don't think Judas did it for the money. It wasn't all that much money. He gave the money back, tried to give it back. I believe Judas thought this was the moment. If only Jesus would make his move, he'd have the people with him. He won't make his move. What can I do to get him to move? I got it. I'll get the soldiers to make their move first. I'll force his hand. Only it didn't turn out the way he expected. Peter thought that he alone was going to be the one to defend Jesus. If they all fall away, I'll be there to the death. Until Jesus turned out to be a different kind of Messiah than Peter imagined. Put away your sword. There isn't going to be a fight. And Peter is denying that he even knows him. The disciples thought they were protecting their own skin. Don't want to get too close to that. The priests thought they were protecting orthodoxy by destroying the Son of God. The government thought it could maintain control by ignoring justice. And the crowd thought that maybe they'd see one more demonstration of power, and if not, they'll have the satisfaction of seeing this pretender die. Let him come down, and we'll believe. But had he come down to convince them, he wouldn't have been able to save them. And two thieves with him. One on each side. The first says, "Save yourself and us." And in refusing to do so, he did so. And I submit to you that in that whole incredible scene, there is only one man who understands what's going on, and that's the second thief. "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." The second word Luke records Jesus as saying is directed at him. Verse 43, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." The word is paradisos. It's found in only two other places in the New Testament, 2 Corinthians 12, verse 4, where Paul talks about being caught up into the third heaven, up into the paradise of God, in Revelation 2, 7. In the Old Testament and in extra-biblical literature, that word, paradisos, is used to denote a place of beauty and peaceful tranquility, a place of blessedness, a heavenly place. There's really no doubt that Jesus was saying, "You're going to be with me in the presence of God." And it's the today that is problematic, because I've already commented, we know that Jesus descended into hell, whatever that means, went into that place of God-forsakenness. But it would seem that what he's saying is, I've got to go through all of this, quote, day, unquote, but on the other side is victory. And you're going to share it. And so the focus narrows from the priests and the soldiers and the disciples and the crowd. And out of all the responses of confusion and blasphemy and ridicule, hatred and cynicism, outright abuse, the miscarriage of justice, the failure of nerve, the focus narrows to three men. On the one side, a thief saying contemptuously, "If you are the Son of God, save us." And on the other, another thief saying, "Lord, remember me." And the story presses the inescapable question, which side of the cross are you on? Jesus' final word, verse 46, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." Did he lose his faith? No. He lost his God. But even as he stepped into that God-forsakenness, he entrusted himself to God. And now, as Paul Harvey would say, let's hear the rest of the story. Jesus died on Friday afternoon at 3 p.m., just as the Passover lamb was being slain, the real Passover lamb was giving up his last. I'm sure that the last thing Jesus heard was the priest blowing his shofar to announce that the Passover lamb had been slain. The women could only begin the burial process because it took a very long time to do all that was involved, and they had only 3 hours before the Sabbath began at 6 p.m. Those 3 hours Friday afternoon constitute part of one day. The Sabbath then ran from 6 p.m. Friday to 6 p.m. Saturday, a second day. And by daybreak on Sunday, we're well into a third day, even though in actual fact, it's less than 40 hours later. The women returned at first light to finish the Jewish rite of embalming. It wasn't embalming in the same way that the Egyptians did it. They removed internal organs and did things that would preserve bodies for literally thousands of years. The Jews did not do that. But they had a kind of an embalming that involved washing the body, cleansing it, pouring oil into its wounds, anointing it with oils and spices, wrapping it in successive layers of linen, and in between the layers, myrrh and aloes and other spices. Typically, it would weigh as much as 100 pounds of linen and spices. As I said, they had only been able to begin that process. They have to stop for the Sabbath, and at the first opportunity, somewhere around 6 a.m., I assume, on Sunday morning, they came to finish. They knew that Pilate had sealed the tomb with a mighty stone. This would be a round stone with flat sides so that it could slide in a trough across an opening to a grave, a cave, really. They knew that Pilate had sealed the tomb with such a stone, and he posted a guard to prevent tampering. They hoped that some of the soldiers would move the stone so they could complete their sad labor of love. No soldiers. No stone. No body. Two men. Chapter 24, verse 4. While they were perplexed about this, suddenly two men in dazzling clothes stood beside them. Elsewhere called angels, God's messengers. They declare he's not here. He has risen. And the women, I love this, the women became the first to proclaim the resurrection. Those sturdy apostles who had been with Jesus for 3 years thought it an idle tale, verse 11. And even at the very end, when Jesus is eating with them just before he's taken up into heaven, when he says, "Touch me, I'm not a ghost," it says some of them were disbelieving for joy. I love that phrase too. Don't you? Disbelieving for joy. Too good to be true. Verse 41. I don't think any honest reading of the account will allow any conclusion other than their being totally and completely surprised by the resurrection. The women didn't expect anything other than a sealed tomb with a dead body inside of it. Their only question was, who's going to move the stone for us? The apostles didn't believe it when the women testified of it. Could hardly believe it when they're in the presence of the risen Christ. And the key is this. It seems so strange to us because we're seeing it all in retrospect, but the key is this. For the same reason they couldn't accept Jesus' repeated teaching about his death, because that doesn't fit Messiah, for the same reason that they couldn't accept his death, how could they anticipate his resurrection? It boils down to this conundrum. If he was the Christ, how could he die? And if he's dead, how could he be the Christ? And if he's not the Christ, how could he come alive again? There was no expectation of resurrection. The notion that the apostles made up the story is totally bankrupt. Number one, they didn't have the courage to do it. To make up such a story involving somehow getting past the guard, past the seal of the tomb, stealing the body, hiding it, getting rid of it somewhere else, and then saying, he rose. They didn't have the courage to do that. These guys are afraid to be near the crucifixion. But beyond that, it seems to me that that absolutely crashes on a moral self-contradiction. They're proclaiming that this man is God and worthy of all of our allegiance for this life and through death if need be. And all that is based upon a lie? What kind of a God is that? And who would die for such a story if you knew it wasn't true? The one thing that that theory so often repeated, the apostles made it up, the one thing that that proves beyond any argument whatsoever is the body was missing. It wasn't there in the tomb. Sometimes you'll hear people put that sort of explanation in a somewhat kinder way, that they sort of exaggerate it a little bit, you know, in order to help people believe the rest of the gospel. The rest of the gospel, once you remove resurrection and all that pertains to it, the fact that this man is indeed who he claims to be, the fact that this man is forevermore the living God who became one of us, once you take away resurrection and you've got just a human Jesus, you've also taken away the rest of the gospel. Everything else is simply straight Judaism, maybe raised to a little bit higher level. And oh, you've heard it said, but I say to you, Jesus upped the standards, but it is straight Judaism. Everybody believed that already. It's a lot of trouble to go to get people to believe what they already believed, if it's not true. They didn't make it up. They were astonished by it. The truth of the matter is, death couldn't hold him. Death is the ultimate negative. And one of my favorite insights is that a negative has no power over a positive. A nothing has no power over a something. And you can play with that notion. Think about any number of illustrations. Darkness. What is darkness? Darkness is not something. Darkness is the absence of light. If somehow we could make this room totally dark, I mean, totally dark, and I light one match, I've destroyed the darkness. Because darkness is not something, it's just the absence of something, and once you put something into it, it's destroyed. If we could make this room absolutely silent, and then I get John to pluck one guitar string, I've destroyed the silence. Because it's a nothing. And a nothing has no power over a something. Scientists talk about what is actually a theoretical concept at this point of absolute zero, because we've never achieved it. We've come very close. But absolute zero would be the total absence of heat. If you could make this room absolutely without heat and then introduce one little degree of heat, you've destroyed the cold because it's a nothing. John begins his gospel by saying of Jesus, in him was life, and the life was the light of humanity. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not been able to put it out. He's playing with that very same theme. What is death? Death is a nothing. And what happens when you put a something into a nothing? What happens when you put life into death? You destroy death. What happens when you put God into hell? It really ruins the neighborhood. Jesus didn't come to escape death. He came to destroy it. And so, he appeared. And we have lots of bits and pieces of those appearances. Put them all together. He appeared to Mary, to the other women, to Peter, then to the two on the road to Emmaus, then to the 10 in the upper room, Thomas being absent for some reason, we don't know why, on that first Easter evening. Separately, Jesus appeared to his own half-brother James. I wish we had the account of that. James, raised under the same roof with Jesus, up until that moment didn't believe in him, neither did any of the other brothers or sisters, thought he was a madman. Jesus appears privately to James, and he is so converted by that resurrection appearance that he leapfrogs over all the other apostles who had spent all this time as Jesus' followers and becomes the leader of the Jerusalem church. A week later, he appears to the 11, an encore appearance for Thomas, who was present that time. On one occasion, he appears to more than 500 followers. He appears in a room, on a road, on the beach, in the air, and last of all, Paul says, as to one untimely born, he appeared to me. There are really only two possibilities, dear friends. Either this is the most preposterous hoax in the history of the world, perpetrated by men who had no motive for doing so, who lacked the courage to pull it off, and who, in the face of death, never broke, never said we made it up. It is either the most preposterous hoax without foundation in the history of the world, or it is the most glorious good news ever to be proclaimed. Why? Because not only Jesus lives, but those who belong to him. I have trusted him, and he has promised to remember me. Amen.